Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca and on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
We must first imagine something before it can manifest. So today we'll be imagining a world with justice and liberation for all, a place where abundance is universally shared, where science and spirituality have quit being opposite ends of a pole, but have merged, a time when everyone has the opportunity to learn and love. In order to do this, our guest today says we must go far beyond merely signing petitions or making monetary contributions. We must find a way to engage people ever deeper in the ongoing process of transformation. We must make building a regenerative and resilient society our dedicated focus. We must also make it fun, seductive, and inspiring. We'll be exploring this together with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. Daniel Pinchback has been described as a radical futurist. He's a philosopher and keen cultural observer. He was featured in the 2010 documentary 2012 Time for Change and host of the talk show Mind Shift on Gaiam TV. He directed the think tank Center for Planetary Culture. His essays and articles have appeared in a vast range of publications, including the New York Times, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Art Forum, Dazed and Confused, The Village Voice, and many other publications. In 2007, Daniel launched the web magazine Reality Sandwich and co-founded Evolver.net. Evolver currently includes Evolver Learning Labs, a webinar platform, and the Evolver Network, a nonprofit initiative. Daniel also edited the publishing imprint Evolver Editions with North Atlantic Books. He's the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and a new book, How Soon Is Now? From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. Join us for the next hour as we explore the need for an intentional redesign of our outmoded global operating systems with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'd like to just start off going to a story that you tell in your book about experiencing the Sandy hurricane. And that was like a moment for you to sort of relook at things. Can you describe what that was like?
The Sandy hurricane, the one in 2012?
Yes.
I guess that was the one that really hit New York really hard. It made me very aware of how, you know, fragile our systems were and how easily things could, you know, go haywire, you know. And it's definitely a big reminder of climate change and the possibility of sea level rise and all of that type of stuff.
So in and there was like no power for for what, 3 days or something. So it just really reminded you of, as you say, how fragile things can be in a moment.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how you are viewing where we are and what we can do. And I know one of your main premises is that we need to know the territory we're in. We need to know it. And a lot of people don't really understand exactly the crisis that we're in. So I'd love for you to describe a little bit about our present mega crisis.
Sure. I mean, I guess the context that I would just offer before is like, you know, in my new book, How Soon Is Now, I look at, you know, the ecological crisis, but I see it also as an opportunity, as a kind of potential for a global awakening. And I see it potentially as like a rite of passage or initiation that could shift humanity from its present sort of self-involved, self-interested kind of ego-based state to something more, you know, inclusive, transcendent or whatever. But the ecological data is definitely very frightening. And obviously most people don't focus on it, and the media doesn't, you know, focus on it too much, but we're losing like 150 to 200 species a day. And they estimate there's like 8.2 million species on the planet. So we're losing about 10% of the Earth's biodiversity every 10 to 15 years. And that's because we're deforesting, we're you know, spoil out of the tropical jungles and so on. We have like 400 parts per million of CO2, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels were 100 feet higher, temperatures were 4 degrees warmer. So that's like inexorably where we would head to now. But it doesn't happen incrementally over many centuries. It happens more through like sudden jumps. So we're seeing like, you know, this region, right? Lots of forest fires every year. You know, and those are, you know, because even a small change in temperature is drying out the forests, which is leading to more fires, which is releasing more carbon. The forests are carbon sinks, you know, so there's all these different feedback loops in the system that are getting engaged. And kind of the argument of the book is that this really is what needs to become our collective focus, you know, not on, you know, financial capital, you know.
And as you talk about it, you said that it's like an initiation that we're having, that it's a, this can be looked as a rite of passage, I guess you could call it. Can you say something about, I mean, it's so frightening to think of all these facts and all, what is going on, and we want to just turn away from it. We naturally do. But if we look at it, we can also look at it as something that possibly will wake us all up, and that we will go into deciding to choose other things. Can you say something?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of the basic idea of the book. I mean, we're facing something that could lead to our extinction as a species. You know, we know, for instance, there's like these huge deposits of methane, you know, that are frozen under the Arctic and the Siberian, you know, peat frost, whatever, they peat bogs, and they get, you know, as they melt, they erupt, and they release a lot of carbon, you know, CO2, sorry, methane, you know, gas, which is a bunch of, more of a heat trapping gas than CO2. And that caused like the Permian mass extinction, like, you know, millions and millions of years ago, when 95% of all life on Earth went extinct. So yeah, I mean, if we care about our future descendants, you know, now would be the time when we would have to stop like distracting ourselves from what's happening. Because, yeah, we know many things that we can do. And we could really, as I said, yeah, look at it as a kind of spiritual mission, you know, because in a way, like, you know, humanity does best when it has a common goal and something that brings us together to act together.
Just like an example of World War II.
Exactly.
When we tooled up, can describe that for us?
Yeah, well, apparently after the Pearl Harbor attack, the United States shifted all of its factory production to wartime needs, and they taxed the wealthiest people in the society at 94%, and they used all of that money to you know, defeat the common foe. So, you know, when we look at what's happening with climate change and the other ecological issues, that's kind of what humanity would need to do on a global level would be to say, okay, like we're going to take 10, 20 years and this will be our focus. We're going to address this for the health of future generations. And then we could probably move on. And in addressing it, we could actually make the society, we could improve a lot on our social design. And we can think about how, like, you know, we could move into a post-work society, you know, like with automation.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. So first of all, what you're saying is that there is a precedent that we have moved quickly in the past. We have shown that we could do that. And then now you're talking about the kinds of changes we need. A lot of us depend on thinking that, oh, technology is going to really do it for us. And technology might add something. There might be some things there that we'll talk about. But you're talking about it's a change also in consciousness. And you talk about changing the social design. And then you mentioned a post-work situation. What does that mean? What does that look like?
First of all, to back up a little bit, I think, like, you know, we have a little bit of a lack of imagination in terms of how we think what our, you know, society could be. So, like, we're very focused on the idea that progress, you know, has to be in one direction. You know, so for instance, like, over the modern period, the idea was that country living was boring and nobody wants to be a farmer. So all the farmers, all the country people come to the cities, they work these industrial jobs and city life is more exciting and more interesting. You know, and there's some truth to that. But now for you know, we need to think about the fact that, like, our agricultural system, which has now become very industrial and corporate, is also having a very destructive impact on the earth. Like, you know, according to the UN, we have like 60 years of harvest left with this current agricultural system because it depletes topsoil. So we're losing the world's topsoil. But we now know that there are other farming practices that actually replenish and restore topsoil. They just happen to be more labor intensive and would require, you know, more people learning more complex skills about how to work with the land and then sending them back into the countryside. So, for instance, permaculture or no-till farming is a way to keep CO2 in the soil, or organic, you know, farming. And they produce better yields and better food, but it's more labor-intensive. So, yeah, what we'd have to do is, you know, in a way, shift our ideology and our vision of what progress consists of at this point, and say, okay, like, you know, there are also so many people who are out of work or are going to be out of work as time goes on. You know, so why not retrain those people and we can kind of repopulate the countryside and have people, you know, create communities and grow food in a healthy manner that restores the land.
Exactly. And you say no-till. That I'm reminded of a book I read years ago. I think Fukuoka has One Straw Revolution, about broadcasting seeds and without planting them. And it just was a marvelous way of farming that he was looking at that went back centuries.
You know, in my book, I tried to put together a lot of, you know, kind of ideas about things, ways could change, you know, projects that have already shown things could change a certain way. But I probably don't know about a ton of them also.
Right.
Because it's, you know, there's been a huge amount of experimentation. If you look at, like I talk about in Africa, like the Sahel region, you know, the farmers there started to like plant trees everywhere and they were able to reverse desertification and so on. So yeah, there's tons of
examples.
Examples, yeah.
I'm here with Daniel Pinchback. He's the author of How Soon Is Now. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, howsoonisnow.info, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Daniel Pinchback. He's a radical futurist, a philosopher, and he's the author of How Soon Is Now? From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. Daniel, we're talking about new social designs, new industrial designs. Let's talk a little bit about new economic designs, because I know that you say that there's a correlation between economics and the inequality of wealth. So they have to be solved together, so to speak. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, first of all, just step back. Like, what I tried to do in the book was, first of all, understand the situation that we're in. Like, we talked about the ecological issues, and obviously there's geopolitical issues and so on. And in fact, you could look at something like Trump's election, even, or Brexit, you know, having to do with climate change and Syrian refugees and fear of immigration and fear of refugees and so on. And a lot of those refugees are being caused by droughts and by climate change. So it's all kind of an integrated circumstance, right? And, you know, there's sets of technical changes we have to make if we want to flourish and thrive as a species. So those include changing our farming system towards regenerative farming, shifting to 100% renewable energy, not over like 50 or 100 years, but maybe over like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, which we could do if it was like the Second World War and we banded together and we're like, this is what we need to do as a species. We got to do it right now. And then in terms of industry, because industry is very exploitative and destructive of the environment, how we can shift our industry practices to be what William McDonough talks about as cradle to cradle. So they actually support, you know, biodiversity. They're not so, you know, toxic and ultimately not toxic at all. But to make those types of changes, we also have to make changes in our social systems, in our political and economic systems. And so the book also looks at different, you know, approaches to that. And yeah, currently we have increasing economic inequality. I think it's now like 5 or 6 people control more wealth than half the world's population. You know, the wealth has been concentrating up the pyramid, which is what this guy like Thomas Piketty realized in this book, Capital. And he wasn't even like a left-wing economist. He was pretty conservative. But the system, the economic system now works like a funnel, which pulls resources up to the top, to those who already have too much, and away from those who could use it. So, and also the money system in itself is based on debt. Money is created out of debt. When you go to a bank to get a loan, you know, they issue the loan, but they don't issue you the interest on the loan. So you have to then compete against everybody else in society. So the money system is designed to force competition and creates artificial scarcity and creates winners and losers and bankruptcies and so on. So it's pretty inherently destructive. And I mean, Bernard Lyotard, who's a Belgian economist, talks about it as a yang currency, that we have a monoculture money system that's just supports masculine, kind of aggressive, competitive values. And so his idea is that we need countervailing, you know, other ways of exchanging value that support different values. And so he looks at community currencies that you find around the world. You know, there's timeshare systems, time dollars. He proposes a trading currency called the Terra, which would have a negative interest charge. So it's sort of like has a time stamp on it. And as soon as you have it, it starts to lose value. So rather than seeking to hoard it, which wouldn't work, you then want to just keep it in circulation, which is kind of interesting because that's also, you know, more how blood and energy circulates through an organism, through a body. You know, it's like our bodies don't hoard, you know, energy in a few cells and deprive the rest of the cells of life. It circulates. So that's another kind of basic theory of the book, is that we can learn a lot from evolutionary biology, and we can even think about humanity as kind of a giant organism, like a huge super planetary superorganism that is always in a symbiotic relationship with the Earth as a whole system. But then we would have to think about how we change our social systems, our technical systems to you know, support the health of the whole body, the whole organism.
You know? I want to remind our listeners or inform our listeners, if you want to know more about the work of Bernard Lyotard, just go to our website, put in the tag economy, something like that, and he'll pop up with several interviews that we've done with him about that economic system. So it really gives us another whole view, as you say, to look at an economic system not based on scarcity, but one based on abundance in some ways, and that keeps the circulation going. So that, but that, Daniel, huge. I mean, we're talking about a huge shift in the way we create wealth in abundance in the world. I mean, we're so used to this other economic system. I'm trying to get to grab hold of how will this start to give us a tipping point towards a new way of doing economics and doing exchange. How can we actually start to move toward this in a real way? What are the first steps we can take as individuals and as a small collectives?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, since we don't have totally answers right now, we're in a period of maybe experimentation. And there are different tools for experimentation, like friends of mine started one called Time Republic, which is basically like with a K at the end, where you can basically, it's online, and you create a profile, and instead of using money, you exchange hours, you know, so you can give somebody some hours and do something for them in return or whatever. I mean, Bitcoin is very interesting. That's you know, a monetary system. It's a cryptocurrency that was based on the blockchain, and it's based on mathematical formula. Very complex mathematical equations that require a huge amount of processing power. So there could only be 21 million of them in the world, but they're infinitely subdividable. So in a way, it's almost like more backing it than the dollar, right? Which is just based on, which is infinitely inflatable, you know? So I think what we'll see, we're going to see more and more of these experiments and, both in terms of financial systems and in terms of social systems, ways for people to work together, you know, democratically.
I know that you've also spoken something about private property and this goes back to maybe Bucky Fuller from years ago talking about how what is private property and what does it actually do in our social structure?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I gave myself the permission in the book to think very freely and very, you know, radically, but I think, you know, rationally about a lot of what's happening. And a number of the thinkers who I most admire and respect all really reached a same perspective that, you know, private property in an excessive form is sort of something that won't allow us to have a truly sustainable society or truly regenerative society. You know, Rousseau wrote a book called wrote an essay called "The Discourse of the Origin of Inequality," and he found that private property was the somebody separating land and saying this is mine created the initial inequality. You know, Marx noted that instead of connecting to our senses and our feeling of being alive, people became kind of possessed by what he talked about, the sense of having, like this urge to own and control replaced our innate connection to the world around us. You know, Oscar Wilde also felt that we needed something more like a kind of, which some people were jokingly called like luxury, you know, fully automated luxury socialism, you know, where, we give up some of our desire to own private wealth, but in return, we have a society that functions, you know, for everybody.
So in this kind of place or this kind of society, community is extremely important. And I guess one of the basic needs of us is to be loved and to love and to be trusted and respected. And this would offer us the opportunity to put more of our energy into that kind of social structure than to hoarding goods and things, money and material things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way, a lot of the book has been informed by, you know, by visits to and interest in like traditional cultures or tribal societies, you know, that are community based. Also, I've been visiting a community in Portugal called Tabera, which has sought to create kind of like an alternative social design for community that also allows for non-possessive, transparent relationships, so people can have like multi-partner relationships and so on. And you know, there's a lot of evidence that when we were nomadic people, you know, tribal nomadic people, the types of relationships we had were, you know, there were looser affiliations. There wasn't this tight idea of the monogamy, you know, the nuclear family and so on. These are modern constructs in a way.
Some have suggested that, okay, we've tried nuclear family for a while now, some decades, and we've discovered it doesn't work.
Right.
It has failed in some ways as we look at our children and look at the problems that they're having. And so let's say this experiment in Portugal.
Yeah.
Then and you're saying it's open, it's not monogamous,
right.
It's open. So what happens with the children? That's the main sort of thing that people would say, well, we need to have one wife, one husband, and to raise the children and so forth. This is a different model.
Yeah, well, that community, the children are raised by the community. I mean, you know, obviously they have a close particular relationship with their particular mother and whatever, obviously. But, you know, there's a children's compound, so a lot of the kids will live in a children's center when they're you know, a little bit older. And essentially the women are therefore kind of freed because here, you know, kind of like... I think women, one reason that open relationships, polyamory often fail is that women are very scared because they don't want to make a huge, you know, investment in a child and have the man leave them. And then it's like, really, that's their whole adult life is just dealing with that circumstance. So if you have a community structure and the woman knows that, you know, any child she has is going to be supported by the whole community, it's a lot safer for her to have the child, to continue to, you know, to explore, so it seems to be working very, very well. And it's interesting because it's actually like the most powerful figures in the community are actually the elder women who kind of are the glue that hold the whole thing together and sort of keep the principles and the ethics and the codes of it kind of in everybody's bones.
That goes back to many indigenous cultures where that underneath the structure or holding the foundation of the structure is the elder women.
Right. And you know, that's something that it's like the opposite. Now, like in our society, the elder women are kind of like shunted out and you know, the different generations, like if you're in the 20s, you're just with your people in your 20s or your 30s, you don't even see the old people, you know. So I think that's, you know, something that I really don't think, I think it makes people very unhappy, actually. I think we'd be much happier back in that type of multi-generational community structure. Where there was a deeper sense of shared support and recognition of people's different gifts and abilities. So I guess, yeah, in a way, like I propose in the book, once again, we have to, you know, we're in this ideology of modernism and postmodernism that progress looks a certain way and it's going to be like more gadgets and more technologies and more isolation. But we don't have to do that. We could stop where we are. We could be like, well, wait a second. We're not only destroying the planet, people aren't even happy in the way we're going. So why don't we use our intelligence and our you know, everything we've learned from psychology and anthropology and all the other studies we've done and re-engineer our system so that we're happier.
May it be so. I'm here with Daniel Pinchback. He's the author of How Soon Is Now, From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. And to know more about his work, you can go to howsoonisnow.info. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here.